Chapter 12. Baggy had some reservations about the Ruffin story.
"It's not really news," he said as he read it.
I'm sure Hardy had alerted him that I was considering a large front-page story about a family of Negroes.
"This stuff is usually on page 5," he said.
Absent a murder, Baggy's notion of front-page news was a hot property line dispute being waged in the courtroom with no jurors, a handful of half-asleep lawyers, and a 90-year-old judge brought back from the grave to referee such matters. In 1967, Mr. Caudle had shown guts in running black obituaries, but in the 3 years since then, the Times had taken little interest in anything on the other side of the railroad tracks. Wiley Meek was reluctant to go over with me and photograph Callie and Esau in front of their home. I managed to schedule the picture taking on a Thursday at midday. Fried catfish, hush puppies, and coleslaw. Wiley ate until he had trouble breathing. Margaret was also skittish about the story, but as always, she deferred to the boss. In fact, the entire office was cool to the idea. I didn't care. I was doing what I thought was right. Plus, there was a big trial around the corner. And so, on Wednesday, May 20th, 1970, during a week in which there was absolutely nothing to print about the Castlelaw murder, the Times devoted more than half of its front page to the Ruffin family. It began with a large headline, "Ruffin Family Boasts 7 College Professors." Under it was a large photo of Callie and Esau sitting on their front steps, smiling proudly at the camera. Below them were the senior portraits of all 8 children, Al through Sam. My story began, "When Kalia Harris was forced to drop out of school in the 10th grade, she promised herself her children would be able to finish not only high school, but college as well. The year was 1926, and Kalia, or Callie as she prefers to be called, was, at the age of 15, the oldest of 4 children. Education became a luxury when her father died of tuberculosis. Callie worked for the Desjarnet family until 1929 when she married Esau Ruffin, a carpenter and part-time preacher. They rented a small duplex in Lowtown for $15 a month and began saving every penny. They would need all they could save. In 1931, Alberto was born. In 1970, Dr. Alberto Ruffin was a professor of sociology at the University of Iowa. Dr. Leonardo Ruffin was a professor of biology at Purdue. Dr. Massimo Ruffin was a professor of economics at the University of Toledo. Dr. Roberto Ruffin was a professor of history at Marquette. Dr. Gloria Ruffin Sanderford taught Italian at Duke. Dr. Carlotta Ruffin was a professor of urban studies at UCLA. Dr. Mario Ruffin had just completed his Ph.D. in medieval literature and was a professor teaching at Grinnell College in Iowa. I mentioned Sam, but didn't dwell on him. By phone, I had talked to all 7 of the professors, and I quoted liberally from them in my story. The themes were common: love, sacrifice, discipline, hard work, encouragement, faith in God, faith in family, ambition, perseverance, no tolerance for laziness or failure. Each of the 7 had a success story that could have filled an entire edition of the Times. Each had worked at least 1 full-time job while struggling through college and grad school. Most had worked 2 jobs. The older ones helped the younger ones. Mario told me he received 5 or 6 small checks each month from his siblings and parents. The 5 older ones had been so tenacious in their studies that they had postponed marriage until in their late 20s and early 30s. Carlotta and Mario were still single. Likewise, the next generation was being carefully planned. Leon had the oldest grandchild, age 5. There were a total of 5. Max and his wife were expecting their 2nd. There was so much material on the Ruffins that I ran only part 1 that week. When I went to Lowtown for lunch the next day, Miss Callie met me with tears in her eyes. Esau met me, too, with a firm handshake and a stiff, awkward, manly hug. We devoured a lamb stew and compared notes on how the story was being received. Needless to say, it was the talk of Lowtown,
with neighbors stopping by all Wednesday afternoon and Thursday morning with extra copies. I had mailed a half a dozen or so to each of the professors. Over coffee and fried apple pies, their preacher, Reverend Thurston Small, parked in the street and made his way to the porch. I was introduced, and he seemed pleased to meet me. He quickly accepted a dessert and began a lengthy summary of how important the Ruffin story was to the black community of Clanton. Obituaries were fine, and in most southern towns, dead black folks were still ignored. Thanks to Mr. Caudle, progress was being made on one front. But to run such a grand and dignified profile of an outstanding black family on the front page was a giant step for racial tolerance in the town. I didn't see it that way. It was just a good human interest story about Miss Callie Ruffin and her extraordinary family. The Reverend enjoyed food, and he also had a knack for embellishment. On his second pie, he became monotonous in his praise for the story. He gave no indication of leaving any time that afternoon, so I finally excused myself.